Hi there, Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana. Thanks for joining us for this podcast. We had Professor Michelle Bryan on the program to talk about the CSKT Water Compact. She's with the Alexander Blewett III School of Law, professor of the Natural Resources and Environmental Law program there. Thought she did a really good job of explaining some of the actual language in this compact. And, you know, it's been a century-long water conflict, decades-long process for resolution here. It has come to, I'm going to have to say, a quasi-final conclusion there with the official implementation. Recently, Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, had signed this agreement to initiate it. Lots to learn here. Lots to learn. So without further ado, here is today's Voices of Montana program as we looked at the ink being dried on the CSKT Water Compact. What's it say, with UM Law School professor Michelle Bryan? Michelle Bryan is with us, Professor Michelle Bryan from the University of Montana, Alexander Blewett III School of Law, professor of Natural Resources and Environmental Law there. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Looking out our window at some beautiful fall foliage, and really happy to be on the call with you.
I spent a number of years in Missoula, Montana. It's a lovely place. I know the fall foliage outside your window that you speak of. And you guys have a big game this weekend, too. Not that we'll talk about that. But let's look at the CSKT Water Compact. I know it had gotten political, and it ought to be, or you know, because we have to resolve these things as best we can. Let me ask this basic first question. Is it fully resolved?
The secretary's signature is considered the final step for all parties to the compact who have agreed to it. But never say never, right?
Yeah.
Because this compact is the resolution of water rights that are still under adjudication by the Water Court of the State of Montana. So they will be placed into a preliminary decree, and the Water Court will ultimately rule on whether it's reasonable and fair overall for all the parties. It's a pretty deferential standard. I'm not expecting the Water Court to change with all this hard work that all the parties have agreed to, but there is that final step that it will be signed off on by the State Water Court.
Yeah, and is that, now, let me ask this. The state of Montana approved this compact, I think it was in 2015, and then it takes its time to get through the federal government process there, which was altered a little bit. The compact was altered a little bit. Doesn't it need to go back to the state of Montana then for another approval?
Right, so the legislature signed off. They considered a couple different versions, I think the 2017 version that they signed off on. Then because the federal government is a party to it and provides pretty significant funding and other measures, it has to go through Congress. And then from there, it went to the Tribal Council of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, which approved it. So all parties approved. When Congress ratified it, of course, they had to include language authorizing a lot of the commitments that the federal government had made in the compact and align it with federal laws. So there wouldn't be any reason that the compact conflicted with federal laws. But none of the changes modify the rights of the state of Montana. If Montana felt like their legal obligations had changed under it, there is an escape clause the governor could exercise. But most of the language in the federal act is about authorizing things contemplated in the compact, and the compact, the fine print says there will be some resolution of those federal questions during the implementation stage with the Secretary of Interior.
Gotcha. I appreciate that. Michelle, Professor Michelle Bryan is with us here, Alexander Blewett III, School of Law, University of Montana. A lot of years in natural resources and environmental law here, but looking at the CSKT compact. I could maybe go back and go from the start, because we're going to tend to jump around here a little bit. I'm curious about these claims, the 10,000 claims, some of them far-reaching into eastern Montana. But let's start with what are the valid underlying issues here that necessitate this agreement?
That is a great question. I'll try to answer it succinctly. It's like any legal dispute. This is a settlement agreement where the different parties had legal claims, right? And they had to assess how strong their claims were, how weak they were, give a little, get a little, and reach a place that they could live with. And so from the perspective of state water users, with which I'm more familiar with because my family homesteaded in north central Montana, we have water rights on our ranch up there, irrigation rights, livestock rights. So from a state perspective, we have these state-based water rights that typically date to the time we put water to use first. From the tribal perspective, I should pause and say, and the federal government wanted us to do that, right? They said, move west, homestead, prove up your claim, which required growing crops and using water. But from the tribe side, they were located onto reservations that were their permanent homelands. And with the CSKT, that happened through a treaty in 1855. And so they ceded the rights to occupy other places in exchange for a homeland, and you need water for your homeland. And every treaty is unique, and the Hellgate Treaty, which is among a group of treaties in the Columbia River Basin with Columbia River tribes that all say they have the right to continue to fish in usual and accustomed places on and off the reservation. And so it's a homeland, and they kept this right to fish that they'd always had, which is called a time immemorial right. Mm-hmm. So in order to fulfill, and again, the government wanted that to happen, which facilitated our ability to homestead. So we've got the government sort of pitting, in my mind, different interests against one another for use of a scarce water resource. And the tribes can't have a homeland without water. It'd be hard for us to live in a city like Missoula if we had no water, right? Mm-hmm. And they can't exercise their fishing right if there's no water for the fish to live in. So the courts have long said and read into those treaties that they contain an implicit water right. And in the case of the Hellgate Treaty and the CSKT, their homeland water rights, which included agriculture, would date to 1855. That's earlier than my family's, 1904 water right on the High Line. And their fishery rights would date to time immemorial. And they used historical records to show all the places in Montana where they engaged in that activity. And you're right, if you look at the map, it worked all the way across to Billings. So all of us that claim a water right filed claims in the water court. The tribe filed claims, as you mentioned, totaling 10,000 separate claims. And so the federal government sort of encouraged these uses on our landscape and needed to play a big part in figuring out how to solve the question of how to share the water. So I'll stop there. That's a pretty...
it is complicated, and I've been trying to understand it, and I don't. But I know this process has been going on for quite a while, so there are people who have dug into it and I think do understand it quite well. That's why I'm concerned I can even ask the right questions or the artful question here. But I am curious about these 10,000 claims, as you mentioned. Some of them probably reaching into your homestead if you're looking at central Montana. Does this dismiss those claims? I think you said that they're going to be looked at still in the water court, but or maybe folks are anticipating that the water court will heavily rely on this compact.
Yeah, so in that settlement process where everyone gave a little and got a little, the tribes gave up over 8,000 of their claims, and the remaining basins where they retained some of those off-reservation stream rights, focus on, right, the Flathead area and the Missoula and the Bitterroot areas. as well as the water rights within the reservation. So they relinquished a lot of their water rights claims in lieu of settlement. They had other things they wanted that they felt were more important, predominantly funding to restore pretty massive ecological impacts on the reservation due to the Flathead Indian Irrigation Project, in which the federal government cut through, I think there are 60 separate waterways feeding into over 1,000 miles of canal systems that service the farmland across the reservation. And the tribes, which have different, I think, priorities than someone like my family that wants to irrigate and water their livestock, the tribes have the caretaking of fish as one of their top priorities. So they were really interested in money to restore habitat for the bull trout, which they consider sacred. So they were willing to give up the vast majority of their off-reservation claims. And so what's going before the water court is a much more scaled back area of water rights claims.
I've got about a minute here for this one, too. Any question here, it takes longer than a minute to respond to, really. Let's just finish up with here. You said that there was an implicit water right established with the fishing rights, which are codified. That has been really well established, and that's not going to change?
That is correct, because there were multiple treaties with Columbia River tribes with the same wording that's been litigated multiple times in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it's based on a case out of North Central Montana, actually, that says the court will read in water rights to support the rights that a tribe retains in its treaty.
I'm going to take a break here. Michelle Bryan is with us, Professor Bryan with the Alexander Blewett School of Law. I like saying Alexander Blewett III School of Law because we just say UM's Law School, but we forget about Alexander's contributions there. But we've got more to discuss here as we look at this, what the ink says, now that it's dry, on the CSKT Water Compact on Voices of Montana. It's from Montana for Montana. We're back with more in a bit.
My Beef Checkoff Dollar funds websites like ChuckKnowsBeef.com.
For my Beef Checkoff Dollar, I get beef into Montana classrooms and teach children how to cook.
For my Beef Checkoff Dollar, I get beef promotion around the world.
My Checkoff Dollar pays for farm fairs and for education and places where young people can learn about the benefits of raising beef in Montana and the nutritional value.
Brought to you by Montana beef producers through their $1 per head checkoff.
You know, there's a lot to learn here, that's for sure. And Michelle Bryan, Professor Bryan with the University of Montana, Alexander Blewett III School of Law, has done her fair share of homework on this. I was looking at some of these selected publications here. Valuing sacred tribal water within prior appropriation. I want to, and then just to try to understand the conflict and how you adjudicate and come to a resolution when it comes to water. Michelle, thank you, Professor. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate that. We'll get you back on at some point. I know you have some commitments down the road, and because there's a ton of stuff to talk about as I look at some of your publications. But let's focus back here again on the CSKT. And I just want to ask this question in regards to all these claims. I think there was a case in Idaho that's been referenced by some of the opponents where Indian tribe had maybe 8,000 claims. Only a handful of those were settled in their favor. And I was curious if you may have a large number, 10,000 claims, but once you get one or two or three or four or half dozen of those through the process, precedence is set, and then the rest are expedited or maybe dismissed. Would that process have played out in Montana?
That's a great question, and it's like reading tea leaves. But I would say that it benefited the tribes and the state a lot to settle the claims rather than litigate them in the water court. We've got a counterexample in the state of Wyoming with the Bighorn adjudication. When a court does an adjudication, it can only decide a couple things. It can only decide priority dates and amounts of water rights held by tribes. And it can't address things like what happens on a reservation like the Flathead Reservation, where you've got a majority non-Indian landowners needing water delivered to them and a really checkerboard land ownership pattern. So the water court can't say, well, practically, how would you share this water now that you know who owns which amount?
Mm-hmm.
And so in the Bighorn, the tribe got water, but no financial support to even put the water to use. So it's really just water on paper. And it took three decades, millions of dollars. And to the extent that the tribes have earlier priority dates than state water users, those state water users are vulnerable to call. So in the CSKT compact, they decided to avoid that litigation. The tribe focused on its key places that it had the closest connection to, because the Salish were originally down in the Bitterroot and the Kalispell were up in the Flathead region. And so they focused on those areas for the in-stream flow rights, released the rest in the state, but agreed that all those irrigators, non-Indian irrigators in the reservation, their rights would be recognized.
Watersheds are immense. I mean, we're all connected. For crying out loud, here in Montana, we're still connected to the oceans on both sides, essentially, in our watersheds. And how do we understand that? What does in-stream flow rights establish? And then does the tribe then have right to, claim jurisdiction over other flows, the Clark Fork River or the Bitterroot River or the Missouri River?
Okay, those are great questions. So if we think about water law in general, before we even talk about in-stream flow rights, when we have a water right, we look at who is senior and who is junior. And in a time of shortage, a senior user with an earlier date could ask the junior to curtail withdrawing water and leave water, let water flow to the senior user. So if we put that in the context of an in-stream flow right, an in-stream flow right is not diverted. It's left in the water, and it's protected so that you've got a protected reach of a stream. In that reach, that water right holder is entitled to have a certain amount of flow. So not only tribes have in-stream flow rights, the state of Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has them to protect fisheries. And we have nonprofit organizations that have them, like Trout Unlimited and the Clark Fork Coalition. So it's a concept that exists beyond just a compact. But in that protected reach, they would have the right to a certain flow if that right was senior to junior users. So state of Montana negotiated for some pretty important protections, though. Where could the tribe make a call? It can only make a call on three streams where it holds time immemorial rights: the Kootenai, the Swan, and the main stem of the Lower Clark Fork. And it gave up the right to call on any tributaries, and it can only call irrigators in a time of shortage. So that's part of what the state got. They got protection for those non-Indian irrigators on the reservation who get the same priority date as the tribe. They get that 1855 priority date. And they got protection from call on all those tributaries. So that's just an example of the give and take.
I get that. I got to take a headline break, and we'll come on back and maybe talk in general about the what kind of precedents this does set moving forward. Professor Michelle Bryan with us here outside of teaching, served as a board member and past president of the Montana Justice Foundation. As you heard her say, her family homesteaded in central Montana, has worked with private landowners, also nonprofits and local governments as well. So we're continuing our discussion here on the CSKT Water Compact. The ink is dried after these headlines from Brian Bennett. You know, one of the publications I should mention here, because I'm in favor of collaboration, and I don't know if we have a firm enough footing for it at times, but learning both directions, how better federal local land use collaboration can quiet the call for federal land transfers. That's one of the publications from Professor Michelle Brine, University of Montana, Alexander Blewett III, School of Law. Professor, thank you again for being here. What kind of precedents are we looking at here from this compact?
Well, in some ways, it's the final piece in the Montana compacting process, because the state of Montana compacted with different federal agencies who hold federal lands in Montana. So we've got a compact, for example, on Glacier Park, Yellowstone Park, National Forests, and so on, and the seven different reservations within the system have compacts. This was the hardest one. They saved it for last. I think it's the most innovative one I've seen, and I think it's a model for other tribes in other states to look at for a couple of reasons. One is that they created a unified administrative code that governs the reservation. Most compacts say the state will decide the state water uses on the reservation. Tribes will decide the tribal uses. Here, recognizing water is a unitary resource. It's underground, it's above ground, it's all connected. They created one code for people on the reservation that want to develop a new water right or change a water right in some way, and they go to a body that can be governed by Indian and non-Indian users. So that's very innovative. The other thing they've done is build in adaptive management when there's drought. And as the tribe is getting that federal money and rehabilitating the irrigation project, they're making it more efficient, putting flows back in for the fish. But in a drought year, there will be a shared shortage where the irrigators and the fishery both take a little less rather than one taking all at the expense of the other. So some pretty innovative tools in there that I think we could all benefit from.
Where are the holes?
Yeah. There's going to be some issues with the lower Clark Fork in-stream flow right, and they've put some cushion in there that the tribe can't make a call on it for 10 years while they try to figure out how to make that system more efficient so that juniors don't lose out in a time of drought. And so they need to work on that and figure it out to try to avoid conflicts there.
Good. And you think there's firm footing for those collaborative efforts?
I think so. We have a lot of interest groups in this basin that are used to working together. I'm hopeful that they will work it out.
Yeah, me too. I hope we work everything out. Not just our water, but everything else we got going on. So you're studying this, aren't you, Professor?
Yep, I'm currently writing an article on it, and I just, with two water court judges, put out the Montana Water Law Treatise, so I'm in the thick of it.
How will you know when you're done?
How will I know when I'm done? When I hit send.
Okay.
I don't think anyone will ever be done, and I'm really impressed with the people implementing this complex document. They have my highest respect.
Thank you for the discussion, Michelle. Take care. We'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Voices of Montana continues right after this.